We're on Mem Zayin Amud Aleph, the second line, the second word where it says Ha Sula Mali. Our Mishnah discussed the case where a person is chashed. He is suspect with respect to being trusted to take an oath, and therefore practically is disqualified from taking an oath. And the Mishnah offered several examples of how a person would become disqualified from taking an oath. The Mishnah started with a case where a person is known to have previously taken a false oath. Such a person would lose his credibility, and if, on a new occasion, he was involved in a court case where normally he could swear and be exempt from payment, we would not allow him to swear. Instead, the plaintiff would swear and collect. The Mishnah offered another example of a person who would be disqualified, of Mesachik Bekuvya, who plays with the dice, meaning a chronic gambler. And the Mishnah also lists the other classic cases of people who have become disqualified. Usually we talk about it in the context of testimony. The same applies to taking an oath. We wouldn't trust these people to swear in court either. The Gemara wonders, Hasu Lamali, why do I need these further examples at all? The point already seems clear. The Mishnah already mentioned that if somebody had previously sworn falsely, then he would be disqualified today from taking a Shavua. So why was it really necessary for the Mishnah to go into these other cases, like the gambler, and these other people who are deemed, not trustworthy? Why was all of this necessary? The Gemara answers, Tana Psula Deraisa. The Tana of the Mishnah begins with these cases where somebody actually took a false oath in court, whereby the disqualification is a biblical one. That person is biblically disqualified. Uketani psula derabanan. The Mishnah then continues with these other cases, the gambler, when he charged the interest to another Jew, where the disqualification is only on the rabbinic level. So that's why we have these two sets of cases of people who would be disqualified from swearing. The Mishnah then presented a dispute regarding a case where hayu shnehen chashudin. Let's say both the defendant and the plaintiff were disqualified from being able to take oaths. What happens in that case? Our Mishnah said that according to Rabbi Yossi, we say, Chazra Shvua L'Mekoma, the oath obligation returns to its place. A bit vague in what's that saying. The Gemara will explain later what it means. But that, according to our Mishnah, was Rabbi Yossi's opinion. The Mishnah then said that according to Rabbi Meir, they would simply split the money in their dispute. The Gemara begins with the discussion that apparently the text that we have in our Mishnah is controversial in terms of how it attributes these two opinions. So Amarle Rava, the Rav Nachman Rava asked Rav Nachman, Hechi Tnan, what is the proper text of this case, of this dispute? Amarle Rav Nachman said back, Lo Yadano, I don't know, I'm not quite certain what the correct text is. Rava asked further, Hilchas Amai, all right, you're uncertain of the text. Do you know whom the halach is like? How do we rule on this issue? Amarle, once again, Rav Nachman answered, Lo Yadano, I do not know. The Gemara now brings an opinion on this. Itmar. It was stated that Amar of Yosef bar Minyumi Amar of Nachman. Here's the correct reading. Rabbi Yossi Omer Yachloku. Rabbi Yossi was actually the one who said that the halacha here is that they split the money. Mechein Tani Rav Zvid bar Oshia. Rabbi Yossi Omer Yachloku. Rav Zvid bar Oshia also taught a brisa that says the same thing. The Rabbi Yossi said they split the money. Gemara brings Ikad Yamri, there's a different version at Tani Rav Zvid. Rav Zvid taught a brisa in which it says, Omer Rabbi Yoshia, Rabbi Yossi Omer Yachloku. Interestingly, in this version, it appears that Rabbi Yoshia himself appears in the brisa, in the Rabbi Yoshia is an Amora. Anyway, Rabbi Yoshia himself says that Rabbi Yossi said that the halachi is that they split the money. Gemara continues, Omer Rabbi Yosef bar Minyumi. Avad Rav Nachman Uvda Yachloku. In an actual case that came up, Rav Nachman ruled that they split the money, which would be Rabbi Yossi's opinion according to the text that we just quoted, whereas our Mishnah's text, as we have, would be, this is Rav Meir's opinion. Either way, the Gemara says that Rav Nachman in the end concluded that the halacha in this situation where both litigants are disqualified from taking an oath is that they split the money. And this is what we would expect in light of the fact that Rav Nachman earlier taught the text in which Rabbi Yossi is the one who says we split the money. For there is an established rule that says whenever you have a dispute between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yossi, the halacha follows Rabbi Yossi. We're not discussing the other opinion of Chazra Shvua L'Mekoma, which sounded somewhat vague. This opinion, which is Rabbi Yossi according to Armish's text, or Rabbi Meir according to the text that Rav Nachman, the Gemara, taught above. This opinion said that if both litigants are disqualified from swearing, then the oath goes back to its place. So it's not immediately clear what that means. So The Gemara asks, Lehechen Chazra, where exactly is this opinion saying the oath goes back to? The Gemara brings two interpretations of this position. Amar Rabbi Ami. Rabbi Ami said, Rabbi Seinu Shebebavel Amru. Our teachers in Bavel said that it means Chazra Shvua L'Sinai. The matter reverts to the oath that we all accepted at Har Sinai, to observe the mitzvahs, in particular the mitzvah of do not steal. And what the expression means is that both of these litigants are not qualified to swear, and the court simply does not impose an oath, and the defendant will not have to pay. Meaning the court cannot force him to pay, but of course he remains bound by the Torah's oath of do not steal. And so we could expect divine punishment if he is cheating here, if he is falsely stating that he does not owe the money. That's the interpretation of the Rabboseinu Shebebavel. However, Rabboseinu Shebe'eretz Yisrael Amru, our teachers in Eretz Yisrael, however, said that it means Chazra Shvua L'Mechuyevla. If the plaintiff is also disqualified from swearing, then the oath obligation returns to the person who was originally obligated to swear, which of course is the defendant. And since practically he is unable to swear, he therefore will have to pay. That's how Rabboseinu Shebe'eretz Yisrael interpreted. The Gemara now identifies this Rabboseinu Shebe'bavel and Eretz Yisrael. Amar Rav Papa. Rav Papa said Rabboseinu Shebe'bavel Ravu Shmuel. The position described as our teachers in Bavel is referring to the Amorayim Rav and Shmuel. And Rabboseinu Shebe'eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Abba. Our teachers in Eretz Yisrael is a reference to Rabbi Abba. The Papa now proves that, indeed, these are the respective interpretations of Rav and Shmuel and Rabbi Abba. Starting with Rabboseinu Shebe'bavel, Rabbi Shmuel, let's prove that in the opinion of Rav and Shmuel, we say, Chazu Shvua L'Sinai. If neither could swear, then the defendant will simply be exempt. He does not have to pay. The Gemara shows that they hold this from Ditnan. Our Mishnah stated, "Cheina yisomin lo yiparu ela b'shvua," that orphans are collecting a debt that was owed to their father, must first swear that to the best of their knowledge, the debt wasn't already collected. Now, Vavina and Bob, we're going to ask later on Memches, we analyze this part of the Mishnah. The Gemara is going to ask a question. Miman, from whom must they take a shvua? Who is the opposing litigant in this case where the orphans have to swear? Ilema milova, if you say that they're swearing in order to collect from the original borrower who borrowed from their father, that Gemara will say doesn't make sense for Avu on Shoko below Shvua Venu Bishvua. Why should they have to swear? Seeing as how, if their father had collected this debt, which was recorded in a document, the father would have simply produced the document and would have collected. He wouldn't have to swear. If he has a document that says there's a debt and there's nothing to discuss, he would simply collect. But they, these orphans, for some reason have to swear. Why would they have to swear? They too should be able to simply present the document and collect from the borrower. The Gemara therefore will conclude that Ela Hachi Kamar. Rather, this is what the Mishnah is saying. V'chein ha-yisomen mina yisomen lo yiparu la b'shavua. The Mishnah is referring to a case where the borrower also died. And so the orphans of the lender are collecting from the orphans of the borrower. Once you're collecting from orphans, so then the Rabbanan imposed this requirement to first swear that to the best of their knowledge, the debt has not yet been paid. Now, it's important to realize that the oath that their deceased father, the original lender, would have had to take if he was collecting from the borrower's orphans is a different oath than they take. For the father would swear, you know, I swear the debt was not paid. You know, and he swears that with utmost certainty that he knows for a fact it was not paid. The orphans swear, on the other hand, they can't really swear that they know absolutely, you know, for sure 100% it wasn't paid. They're only able to swear that to the best of their knowledge, as far as they know, you know, they didn't receive any indication that it was paid. And yet, that oath apparently is acceptable, but V'rav u'shmuel de'omri tarvayu, Rav and Shmuel there in that discussion on tomorrow's daf, qualify this as follows. They say, Lo shonu ela shemes malva b'chaye lova. We'd only accept the orphan's oath and allow them to collect in a case where the lender predeceased the borrower. In which case, the original lender never had an obligation to swear. Because as long as he was alive, the original borrower was alive. As we said above, the lender doesn't have to swear before collecting from the original borrower. And so if the lender dies, and now his orphans want to collect, and then the borrower dies, we accept what the orphans swear, that to the best of their knowledge, the debt was not paid. Avo meis lova b'chaye malva. But if the borrower had predeceased the lender, in that case we say, Kvar nischayev malva lebinei lo v'shvua. There's a problem for the lender's orphans, because their father already incurred an obligation to swear. If he would want to collect from the borrower's orphans, the borrower had already died. If he would want to collect today, he would have to swear that he knows for a fact that this debt was not collected yet. But then he went and died. So here we have a problem for v'ena the morish shvua lebanav. The father, this lender, cannot pass through inheritance this debt, which can only be collected by taking an oath, taking a very specific oath, that I know for a fact the debt was not paid. His orphans cannot do that in his place because they're simply, you know, unable to make such a declaration. They can't say with certainty that the debt was not paid. They weren't the lenders. And maybe their father did collect and just never told them. So it's a situation where the plaintiff has this halachic obligation to swear, but practically cannot do so. They can't practically take that very oath that already, you know, became incumbent on the estate to swear that, you know, I know for sure that I didn't collect the debt. So this really is the equivalent of a situation where you have a person who, you know, normally the halacha would say that he could swear that it's true, he doesn't owe the money, and then he wouldn't have to pay. But the problem is, he's, let's say, a bank robber, in which case he can't swear. We won't trust him to swear. Now, in addition, the other litigants in the case, the borrower's orphans, can't swear either. They don't know for sure that the debt was paid. They can just claim, well, maybe it was paid, but they, of course, you know, can't swear to that. So what do we do in this situation? Rav and Shmuel are saying that in this situation, since neither litigant could swear, the orphans of the borrower do not have to pay. We see that it was Rav and Shmuel we were referring to above when we mentioned these Rabboseinu Sheba Bavel, who likewise said, when you have a situation where both litigants are suspect, it can't be trusted to swear, and the practical halacha is that the defendant does not have to pay. Rav Papa now explains the second part of his statement above. He said that Rabboseinu Sheba Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Abba, he identified the Rabboseinu Sheba Eretz Yisrael to actually be the Amara Rabbi Abba. It is Rabbi Abba who holds that in this situation where neither litigant is able to practically swear, that the halacha is the defendant must pay. We see this as Rabbi Abba's view from the following well-known case, the Abu Gavra, the Chatef Nascha Mechavrei. Once upon a time, somebody grabbed a silver ingot, it's a bar of silver, grabbed it away from his friend. And Asa L'Kamed Rabbi Ami, the case came before Rabbi Ami. Now, Yosef Rabbi Abba Kamei Rabbi Abba was present there when the question was brought to Rav Ami. And this is how the case proceeded. Aisi Echad Sahada de Michtav Chatfa Minei. The plaintiff was grabbed from, brought a witness, one witness. And indeed, this other person grabbed his Nasra from him. Amrlei, the grabber, replied, In, yes, it's true. Chatvi, I did grab this from you. However, Vididi Chatvi, I merely grabbed what was mine. I had every right to grab this from you because the Nascha belongs to me. This case presented a very interesting legal conundrum. Amar Rabbi Ami. Rabbi Ami said, Heichi ledainu dayoni laidina. How should the judges judge this case? Let's go to the possibilities. Nei malei zil shalim. We might be tempted to rule and the grabber has to pay. Listen, by his own admission, he grabbed this piece of metal from this other person. The general assumption is if somebody has possession of something that belongs to him, this guy grabbed it from him, he should be deemed a thief and he should be ordered to pay. So he give it back. However, Rabbi Ami said, not so simple. Because lekatrei sahadi, it must be considered that we didn't receive the information that this person grabbed from two witnesses, from some independent report. Rather, it was only by the grabber's admission that we actually established here that he grabbed this thing from his friend. And therefore that gives the grabber a potential migu argument. That is, you know, believe me when I'm claiming that I grabbed my own thing, because really, you had no evidence that I grabbed this at all, so I could have just denied that it ever happened. On the other hand, if we say niftarei, maybe we should rule that, okay, he's exempt. Look, he has this argument. Clearly, he's not lying, because if he wanted to, he could have just denied the whole thing. The problem with that argument is, ikachad sahada. It's not like we had zero evidence that he did this. There was the one witness that did testify that he did this. Now, one witness is not enough to force somebody to pay, but it does change the calculus here of this Yomigu argument, because the whole idea of Migu is that I would have no problem making that other claim. Much easier claim, could have just said that if I wanted to lie. Well, not so true in this case, because we know when an Erecha testifies, it does force the defendant to swear against that erechatz. Now, it's not so simple to go ahead and just say, oh, it never happened, I never grabbed this. If you would have taken that approach, you would have had to swear. But again, it's not two witnesses, so it's not like, you know, we independently knew as a fact that he grabbed this. So maybe the proper ruling is, Neimalei zilish taba. Okay, you know, what do we normally do when an erechat testifies? We have the defendant swear against the erechat if he wants to avoid payment. Well, the problem is, kivin de omer michtav chatvi, since the person himself acknowledged that he did grab the thing away, havelei kegazlan. In effect, the grabber here is considered a gazlan, a thief, with respect to the possibility of swearing. We know, of course, that a gazlan is disqualified from taking an oath. So to this person, he can't take an oath against the erechat because he agrees with the erechat. He says, yeah, it's perfectly true that I grabbed it, but he is claiming that grabbing it was perfectly fine because it belongs to him. So swearing in this situation is, you know, simply not an option. The idea of swearing against the erechat has to take the form of, you know, swearing directly against what the erechat said, which is not possible here. So how should the judges judge this case? Amar lei Rabbi Abba. Rabbi Abba said to Rabbi Ami, this is my opinion on the matter. Essentially, we have a situation where really the defendant, this grabber, ought to swear because of the eidechad, but he practically cannot swear, as we explained. So what do we practically do? The halacha is, if you can't swear, too bad. Okay, then you're going to have to pay. So we see that the Rosein Hashem Eretz Yisrael that we referenced above was referring to this opinion of Rabbi Abba, who says that the way we handle a situation where practically no one is able to swear is that, okay, the original defendant who was supposed to swear will have to pay. You know, just like if an erechad, you know, said somebody owes money and the defendant says, I'm not swearing. The halacha certainly in that case is he has to pay. So the same is true if there's some other reason that they're unable to swear, the halacha is that he will have to pay. The Gemara says, Amar Rava kavusei the Rabbi Abba mistavro. Of these two views, we have Rav and Shmuel on one side, Rabbi Abba on the other side. Rabbi Abba's view appears to be correct, a more logical opinion. For the Tani, Rabbi Ami taught a brisa which darshins the pasuk that teaches the halacha that if a shomer is watching something and then, you know, the owner comes to collect it, he says, I'm sorry, it's gone, an unavoidable accident happened. Torah says, in order for him to be exempt from payment, Shvuas Hashem Tia Ben Shneim, an oath of God shall be between them. This shomer, this custodian, has to swear that it's true that this unavoidable accident occurred. Riyami darshins this pasuk that the Torah is teaching us, that, you know, the oath is between them. It stresses that point to teach us, V'lo Ben Ayarshin, the oath would not be applied among the inheritors of these litigants. If the original litigants died, we would not have the heir of the shomer take an oath. Now, the Gemara presumes that this teaching, which excludes the heir from taking an oath, is referring to the other, you know, classical oath situation where the defendant admits to part of the claim. The question is, Hechi Dami, what specifically is the case here? Ilema di Omer le mona le'aba biyad avicha. If you say the case is that we have one orphan representing his father, that he says, my father had a mona, 100 zuz, by your father, so now you have to pay. And the orphan of the alleged debtor claims, Chamshin islay v'chamshin leslay. He agrees that, yes, my father had 50 dinars of your father, but he did not have another 50. It's only 50. And you'll suggest that the Torah is teaching us that the orphan cannot take such an oath, but the Gemara says that's not reasonable. For mali hu, mali avu. Why should the son be any different than the father in such a case? If the son is really claiming with certainty that he knows for a fact the estate only owes 50, so then of course he should swear about the part that he is denying, like any other case where somebody admits to part of a financial claim. So that obviously is not the case that Torah is referring to here. Elalav, rather, must we not say that here's the case. The Omar Lay, one orphan says to this orphan, Mana li abba biyad avicha, my father lent your father 100 zuz. Omar Lay, orphan of the debtor, says back, Chamshin yadana, I know about 50 that my father owed your father. V'chamshin lo yadana, I don't know about this other 50 that you're claiming my father owed. Now this, of course, would be a situation where the defendant orphan is not able to practically swear about what he is claiming. He himself acknowledges that he doesn't know. The Torah is teaching us that the orphan in this case is exempt from the oath. it's not a situation where the orphan, you know, really has to swear but is unable. The Torah says he's exempt from the oath altogether in this situation. So turning to Amid Beis, Rava points out as follows. Yamart bishlama aviv ki agavna michayev. I understand this teaching of the Braisa. If you say that the halacha that would have been applied to the father himself, the original debtor, would be that if he would make the same exact claim, he would say, I know that I owe you 50, I don't know if I owe you another 50. If the ruling for the father is that he really has to swear, and he can't practically swear, because again, by his own admission, he doesn't know. The halacha, therefore, is he has to pay, then very good. Istrich kra'a lemifter gabi yarshin. We understand exactly what the Torah is saying. The Torah is coming to teach us that even though the father in this situation would be liable to pay, his orphan, his heir, is not liable. But Rava points out, Eliyamart, Aviv, Kiai Gavna, Nami, Potter. If we say like the other opinion, like Rav and Shmuel, that the way we handle such cases where the litigants cannot practically swear, is that we say that, okay, the defendant does not have to pay, which means then that the father wouldn't have to pay either. If that were true, Kra Gavi Yarshin Lamali, what's the purpose of this teaching? What practical difference does it make that the orphans don't have an obligation to swear? So what? Even if they did, they wouldn't have to pay. So Rava says, it seems from this braisa, Rabbi Abba is correct, that in fact, if the litigants cannot swear, the halacha is the defendant, litigant, would have to pay. So it comes along the Torah to say that that's true by the father, but not by the orphans. The father would have to pay in this situation, but not the orphan. So it seems to be a proof to Rabbi Abba. And so the Gemara now addresses, V'ravu Shmuel, Hai Shavuos Hashem, Aikad Dar Shibe. How would Rav and Shmuel interpret this pasuk? Obviously, not like the above Braisa did, for that would be incompatible with their position. The Gemara explains, Mi boile l'kedetanya. They need this pasuk for the drasha of the following Braisa. Shimon ben Tarfon Omer. Shimon ben Tarfon says, from this pasuk of Shavuos Hashem Tiyem in Shneim, Torah emphasizes, the oath shall be between these two litigants. By mentioning both of them, not just the defendant, but the plaintiff too, Malamit Shashvua Chalal Shneim, Torah is teaching us that both litigants are responsible. As we learned about on Lamitasimid Beis, an oath is a very serious matter. You're taking the name of God, and especially if it's a false oath, that is a very serious offense. And we learned on Lamites, from Tarfon, derives from this pasuk, that even the plaintiff is responsible. Aye, he didn't take the oath. But the answer is, he shouldn't have gotten involved with this person who shouldn't have been trusted. And so he, like, helped bring about this oath. So both of them, even the plaintiff, is responsible. That's what we darshan from this pasuk, according to Rav and Shmuel. They would go with Shimon ben Tarfon's drasha here. And the Braisa continues with other drushes from Shimon ben Tarfon. Shimon ben Tarfon Omer. He also said, Azhara le'oke v'achar noef minayin. Where does the Torah teach in Azhara, you know, warn against a person who facilitates adultery? Tamil Omar, the Torah teaches this. For when the Torah states this grave sin of adultery, the pasuk says, lo sin of, which, you know, the simple interpretation is, it's addressing the adulterers themselves. However, we darshan, you could read it also, lo sanif, do not cause adultery to occur. So it makes the person who would facilitate such a grave sin also liable. Another drasha from Shimon ben Tarfon regarding the pasuk, which Moshe Rabbeinu rebukes the people for the sin of the meraglim, of the evil spies who gave their slanderous report of Eretz Yisrael. And of course, the people accepted their evil report and gave up. They lost their faith and they cried, they wept that we'll never succeed, we'll never be able to conquer Eretz Yisrael. And this, of course, was a very serious national downfall. Moshe Rabbeinu rebuked the people with the words, Vateirognu bi'olecha, you slandered in your tents. Shimon ben Tarfon Omer. Shimon ben Tarfon says it's not to be interpreted literally that they went in their tents and slander, they were even outside of the tents, but rather it means Tartem v'ginisam v'yalo shel makom. Shabbeinu is intimating that the people, through their, you know, acceptance of the evil report of the Meraglim, thereby disparaged the tent of God, the Mishkan, God's holy presence. It was an insult to the presence of God that the people went along with the evil report of the Meraglim. Another drasha from Shimon ben Tarfon, the pasuk says, Adanar agodol na'ar pros, discussing the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, it says, until the Euphrates River. Shimon ben Tarfon Omer, Shimon ben Tarfon says, Karav l'gabi dehina v'idhan. He remarked with an expression that if one touches an anointed person, that person himself could become anointed. That, you know, positive radiance could rub off on the person who associates, who is near something that is special. So it is with the Euphrates River, which in and of itself wasn't particularly special, but it became very special as a result of hugging the border of Eretz Yisrael. A similar expression, the Bein Rabbi Yishmael Tana, Evid Melech Kemelech, servant of a king, gets like a royal status too. He becomes also like a king due to his association with a person of royalty. So it was with Nahar Pras in relation to Eretz Yisrael. The Mishnah then taught us an additional rabbinic decree involving oaths of this case of Chenvani Alpin Koso, the storekeeper with his ledger. The Mishnah described that what happened was a person trusted a Chenvani and he said, "You know, please extend credit and pay my workers for me." Anyway, later, Chenvani looked over his pinkoso, his ledger, he said, "My records indicate that I paid your workers, so please pay me back." However, the workers claimed they were never paid. The first opinion of the Mishnah said that the halacha here, unfortunately for the balabais, this employer, is that both the storekeeper and these workers, they take a shvua, they swear to their respective claims, and they both collect. They don't have to, you know, listen to each other. They can just, you know, directly deal with the defendant, this employer, and they both collect. The Mishnah then presented the opinion of Ben Nanos, who critiqued this. He said, "We would not institute a halacha which creates a situation where necessarily we have one of these parties is taking a false oath. We don't want to bring about a false oath. Rather," Ben Nanos says, "they both simply collect from the employer." The Rabbanan said, "You know, the employer decided to trust the Chenvani, so now he is basically at the Chenvani's mercy. And you know, he can collect, and the workers say they weren't paid, you know, their belief too. And they also collect, according to Benanis, you know, nobody swears." The Gemara brings a Braisa Tanya. It says that a Braisa Amar Rebbe. Rebbe also remarked on Tanakama's opinion that we have both parties, the Chenvani and the workers, swear. He said, "Tarach Shvua Zu Lama." Why would we burden the parties with an oath? He was also criticizing the proposal to have, you know, both parties swear when, you know, that will mean somebody is making a false oath. Rebbe's statement here was questioned. Amar le Rebbi Chiya. Rebbi Chiya objected to Rebbe that, you know, you apparently are coming to disagree with the first opinion of the Mishnah, but Tanina, you taught in the Mishnah, of course, Rebbe Yehuda Nasi himself, Rebbe was the one who sat down in the Mishnayos and put down the final text of the Mishnayos. And so you presented this anonymous first opinion that says the halach is shneiim nishabayin v'not lemi balabayis. Both parties do swear. And since you taught this opinion anonymously in the Mishnah, that normally indicates that you actually favor that opinion, that you're ruling like that opinion. And yet here you seem to reject this opinion. It appears to be inconsistent. And we don't have a response from Rebbe. So the Gemara wonders whether kibla mine or lo kibla mine. Did Rebbe accept this and therefore retract and rule like the Tanakhama that both parties swear? Or perhaps he didn't, you know, accept this question for whatever reason, even though the anonymous opinion says otherwise, the Rebbe himself ultimately disagreed. What was Rebbe's final opinion on this issue? The Gemara answers with Tashma coming here, a proof from this Braisa Ditanya. It says in the Braisa, Rebbe Omer, Rebbe says, this is the halacha in this case. Po'alin ishboyin lechenvani. The halacha is that the workers swear to the storekeeper that they weren't paid by him. The Gemara says, from these words we can infer what Rebbe's final opinion is. For Ve'im Issa, if it were true that Rebbe did accept Rebbe Chiya's question and therefore simply went back to the Tanakama's opinion that both parties, the storekeeper and the workers, have to swear and then they could collect, well, if that were Rebbe's opinion, why would the workers be swearing to the storekeeper, Labala Bias Miboyle? Well, of course, their dealing is with the employer who they're about to collect the money from. So evidently, Rebbe held his ground about his original assertion, and what Rebbe meant in that assertion, when he said, you know, why have all of them swear, was that actually the halacha is only the workers swear and collect, but the storekeeper does not collect, which means that really, the only losing party here is the storekeeper. Since he is the affected party, that's who the workers swear to. So apparently it seems the Rebbe was not fazed by Rav Chiya's question. However, the Gemara deflects this proof. Amar Rava, Rava said that perhaps really Rebbe accepted the point raised by Rav Chiya, and he therefore concluded that both parties, both the workers and the storekeeper, swear and collect. So why would the oath taken by the workers be done with the storekeeper, says Rava? Poalim nishbayin labalabayis b'mamet chenvani. Could very well be the Rebbe saying that we require the workers to swear. Yes, they of course swear too, the employer, where he's the one they're collecting from, but they do so be mamad chenvani, while in the presence of the storekeeper. Why? So that, you know, in case they're lying, they should be embarrassed from the chenvani. That hopefully if they're lying, they'll be too embarrassed to do so, right? To the chenvani's face, to falsely claim that he did not pay them, and they know full well that he did. So that could be what Rabbi is saying, and so it doesn't, you know, show us how Rabbi concluded on the basic question of, you know, how many parties get to collect. The Gemara now presents a fundamental dispute that appears in different places in Shas, and it's presented here as well because it will be connected back to our Mishnah, Itmar. It was stated, let's say, two pairs of witnesses are contradicted one another. For example, one group of witnesses testified that Reuven shot Shimon. Another group of witnesses testified that Reuven did not shoot Shimon. Clearly, in such a case, we would not prosecute Reuven because of these contradictory testimonies. But the question is regarding the status of the witnesses themselves that have all been involved in a situation where, you know, their testimony was contradicted by the testimony of other witnesses. Amar Rav Huna, Rav Huna said, the halacha going forward is zuba bifnei atzma umeida v'zuba bifnei atzma umeida. We would still allow each group of witnesses on its own, as long as, you know, they were testifying independently, not mixed together with a witness of the other group. They would independently be able to testify, even though, you know, mathematically it's clear one of the groups of witnesses gave false testimony. Which, you know, normally, if someone falsely testifies, then it disqualifies him from testifying in the future. Yet, in this case, since we don't know, of course, which one is lying, therefore, when either group presents itself to us with testimony, we apply the principle of cheskas kashrus, which says that we assume that a person is proper, you know, is credible, unless we know otherwise. We don't know either group gave false testimony, and therefore when each one presents itself, we give them their cheskas kashrus, and they can testify in a future case. However, Rav Chista said, he takes a harder line on this, and he says, "Bahadei sadi shakri lomali." Why would we accept testimony from such false witnesses? That is, since we know that one of these groups gave false testimony, therefore in practice we have to, you know, err to the side of caution, take the stringent position that, you know, possibly this pair of witnesses gave false testimony. They're disqualified witnesses. And so in practice, they would not be able to testify in a future case. The Gemara mentioned some applications of this dispute between Rav Huna and Rav Chista. What first relates, let's say there were two different loans, and the specific circumstances were as follows. There were Shnei Malvin, or Shnei Lovin, two different lenders, two different borrowers, or Shnei Shtaris, and these two loans were recorded in two separate documents, and each document was signed by a different one of these groups of witnesses that were involved in this situation, where they contradicted each other with their testimonies. So, well, possibly, either group might have become disqualified. The question is, what is the status of these loan documents? Where, of course, the halacha is, if a loan document has disqualified witnesses, then it's not valid. It can't be used to collect. Says the Gemara, Hainu pluktayu. This case would be a straightforward application of the dispute between Rav Huna and Rav Chista. That is, that according to Rav Huna, we say that each group of witnesses taken by itself is presumed to be kosher, is presumed to still be kosher witnesses. Therefore, you know, we can clearly look at these two testimonies, you know, in the loan documents separately, the totally separate loans. Therefore, you look at each document by itself, so each document is perfectly fine, and therefore both creditors may collect with it. However, according to Rav Chista, just the opposite. Neither group of witnesses is able to testify going forward, since they were involved in this situation of machisha zuvizu. They were contradicted by other witnesses in the previous testimony. Therefore, each testimony, each of these documents is simply regarded as not valid, so the documents are not valid, and neither lender could collect with his loan document. Gemara continues, what about this case? What if we had malva vilova ushne shtaros? What if it was two loans, but both loans involved the same lender and borrower, who recorded two different loans in two separate documents, and again, each document had one of these groups that were involved in this situation of akasha, that each one was contradicted by the other witnesses. And the case is that the amount of each loan was different. Let's say it was one loan for 200 and one loan for 100. The Gemara says that actually both Rav Huna and Rav Chisda would agree that in this case we say Yad Baal Hashtar Ala Tachtona. The person in possession of these documents, of course, the lender, is at a legal disadvantage here, but at the same time, he will be able to collect something that is, in our example, be able to collect 100. And the reason for this is simple. It is clear that one of these documents presented by the lender is false, and one of them is true. The borrower, you know, cannot claim to the lender, you know, both of these documents are not valid. That's clearly not true. But since the borrower is in the position of a muhsik, he's the one holding on to his money. Therefore, the burden of proof would be on the lender to prove that the larger amount is owed. And assuming he cannot prove that, he would only be able to collect the lower amount. And this will be the halacha, you know, both according to Rav Huna and Rav Chisda. This case would not be a manifestation of their opinions because of the fact that it's the same person using both shtars, that as you know, both groups, using those against this one borrower, and thus, again, it's inescapable that you know one of the loans is true, the other one is false. So, okay, practically it means the lender will be able to collect the lower of the two loans. The Gemara mentions another case, and this is where it ties back to our Mishnah. The Gemara now says, what if shnei malvin velova echad ushnei shtaros? What if the two loan documents that were signed by these, you know, each by one of these two groups of witnesses that were involved in a situation where they, you know, contradicted each other in their testimonies in some previous case, what if the loan documents were produced by two different lenders collecting from one borrower? So one person allegedly borrowed money from these two people. And again, the loans are recorded in two separate documents, each signed by one of these groups of witnesses. Says the Gemara, since it's two different lenders, you know, each, you know, separately bringing their respective claims with their own loan documents, therefore, this is a situation where you have, you know, separate testimonies come from the signatures in each document. Therefore, according to Rav Huna, not a problem at all. Both lenders collect. For again, Rav Huna says, as long as the groups of witnesses are testifying separately, independent of one another, Nalacha deems each testimony as perfectly valid. Therefore, the lender collects both loans. The Gemara remarks that it's Hainu Masnisin. It's very similar to our Mishnah's case, where in the end, the employer gets hit from both sides. He has to pay twice. And while we might feel a little bad for him, but that's, you know, tough luck. Since, you know, in the Mishnah's case, each plaintiff is bringing a credible claim against him. Same thing in this case. Each lender is bringing a perfectly credible loan document. The fact that both groups were previously involved in a situation of contradictory testimonies is irrelevant. As each group is testifying separately, and each group has its own Cheskas Kashrus, a presumption that they are still kosher to testify. So the borrower will have to pay both of them. Even though, you know, yes, you could theoretically start arguing that, what do you mean? But if you would put the witnesses together, then we would know that one of them is false. But that is irrelevant as far as the practical halacha. Now, according to Rav Chisda, just like we said in the first case we mentioned, neither lender would be able to collect because both of these lenders have documents that have these very problematic witnesses who signed because of the, you know, history that they were involved in a case of hakhasha, where they had, you know, contradicted each other. So far, the Gemara was certain about the halacha in each case, according to Rav Huna and Rav Chisda. The Gemara now presents a case where it's not so clear. And that is, let's say we had Beis Lovin Umal Ve'echad Ushnei Shtaros. You had two different borrowers, but it was one lender coming with these two loan documents, one for each borrower, and one of each group of the witnesses that were involved in this situation where they contradicted each other, had served as the witnesses on the documents. The Gemara is not sure in this case whether we consider it that there are two separate testimonies that are happening here because you have two different borrowers who are being claimed from, or do we say, since it's this one lender bringing both documents, maybe we have to view this as, you know, testimonies that are happening together. If so, if it must be considered as, you know, one big case, the practical halacha will be that this lender will not be able to collect from either borrower. Why? Because each borrower can push off the lender saying, and hey, it's clear that these groups of witnesses you're using here, one of them is disqualified from testifying. So I say that the group that signed on the document you're bringing against me was the disqualified group. And indeed, that would be valid, because again, you can't, you know, put on blinders and say, okay, that's a separate testimony, nothing to do with this testimony. No, they're all testifying together. And the other borrower could say the same thing, with the result that the lender would get nothing. Or again, you know, maybe we say, no, since it's two different borrowers, it's considered two different cases, two different, you know, separate occasions of testimony, and therefore the lender could collect both loans according to Rav Huna. So the Gemara's not sure about this case. The Gemara says, take a let it stand. We're not sure about, you know, the halacha in this case. The Gemara now continues with Masiv Rav Huna Bar Yehuda, Rav Huna Bar Yehuda. That's the question on Rav Chisda's opinion from the following Braisa, which discusses Kiddush HaChodesh, that is the process whereby the new month would be determined. The court would pronounce a new month based on the sighting of witnesses who saw the new moon. Now the witnesses would be cross-examined to determine if it's, you know, accurate, truthful testimony. And so the court would question them about, you know, how exactly the moon appeared. So continuing the Mem Ches, the Braisa says, what if the witnesses contradicted each other in describing the moon that they claimed they saw? Echad Omer Gevoa Beis Mardos. For example, one of them claimed that it was this high, Echad Omer Shalosh. The other one said, no, it was three Mardos high. So Raisa says, since it wasn't so off, Fedusa Kayemes, this would not be considered, you know, contradictory testimony, and therefore the testimony would be accepted here. But if Echad Omer Gimel, Echad Omer Hey, if there was a significant discrepancy, say one said it was three Mardos high, the other one said five high, Edus and Betela, this would be a significant contradiction, and therefore the testimony would be null and void. However, the Braisa says, Mitztarfin le'edos acheres, despite of the fact that he had these witnesses who were involved in a situation where their testimony was contradicted, so we now apparently have a situation where one of these witnesses gave false testimony. Nevertheless, either the witnesses could combine with another witness to testify about something else. That is, the Brice appears to be saying, my love, latest moment, is the Brice not saying, it sounds like it's saying, that, you know, even though they were involved in this situation, they could still testify in a future case along with another, a different witness. They can't testify together, but if they testify with another witness, then it's fine, which appears to prove Rav Huna's opinion that, you know, each one, as long as each one is going on their own, we will uphold the person's cheskas kashrus and presume that person is a kosher witness, so it appears to be not like Rav Chisda. However, the Gemara deflects the proof. Amar Rava. Rava said, no, Brisa doesn't mean as we said above. Rather, the Brisa is saying that even though we have a situation here where the witnesses contradicted each other, however, if the case develops further, meaning hu v'yacher mitztarfin le'edos acheres shel Rosh Chodesh, we might be able to get a proper testimony about whether a new moon was seen here. That is, if one of these two witnesses combines with a third witness, and that third witness, you know, says like him, like his description, well then, you know, that would be perfectly valid testimony. Why? Da'avi lehu trei v'chad? Because then it would become a situation where two witnesses describe it one way, and a third describes it a different way. And of course, vein dvarav shelech of malkum shnayim, testimony of a single witness is, you know, nullified in the face of testimony of two witnesses. Two witnesses already is, you know, full-fledged testimony. And the point is that, you know, if this occurred, it would show us that the witness who got together with that, you know, third witness was really telling the truth and the other one was lying. So that other one would be disqualified, but these two would be giving proper testimony. They are kosher witnesses. That's all the Brice is saying. If that's what it's saying, it is no contradiction at all to what Rav Chisda said. So you have no proof against Rav Chisda from this Brice.
You've been listening to RealClearDaf.com. Visit us online for resources or to dedicate a shiur. To speak with Rabbi Wise, call 855-ASK-RCD1. That's 855-275-7231.